Good afternoon, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your lunch or you are still enjoying your lunch. I want to express my gratitude to the colleagues who support us with this great lunch that you prepared for us, the food services here in New Residence Hall, the people who have been serving the food. And thank you very much for the wonderful meal. We're moving now into the third session of our conference. It is a session that stays in the core of the conference. It's a very important session. We call it the student perspective. I would call it rather the perspective of the youth, the perspective of the next generation, the perspective of the people who are, yes, like we all are, also learning, but have a vision that, because of many different factors, is, in my view, most probably broader and longer term for sure than ours. So thank you so much for being with us, to the four speakers in this session. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Professor Carolyn Begg. She's a professor in plant sciences. And Carolyn has been chairing this session for how many years now? Forever. For 8 years, probably. So she is also in charge of helping us in putting together the poster session. There are many other young professionals, students, grad students, and undergrad students who prepare the posters that you see on the walls. So thank you again. Help me, please join me welcoming Professor Begg, and thank you very much again for doing this for us.
Thank you, Hugo, for such a warm introduction. I very much enjoy chairing this session because this shows basically the future, what people are looking towards, what are the interests that they have, and where they're going. And some of the presentations might be challenging and engaging, and I hope this session will be quite dynamic and entertaining. So I invite you to go to the web to look at the bios for all of the four presenters that we have today. But because there are four presenters, I'm not going to give an introduction of each student. I'm simply going to welcome them to the podium and a brief where they're coming from. So their bios are all on the web, so I invite you to look there. So our first speaker today is Daniel Haberman. He's a master's student in the Department of Natural Resource Sciences at McGill University, and he's going to be talking about ecosystems services in a peri-urban environment and how important they are in terms of agricultural production and also just basic living. So I invite Daniel to the stage.
So thank you for the introduction, and good afternoon, everyone. So yes, I'm Daniel Haberman. I'm doing my master's in the Department of Natural Resource Sciences, supervised by Dr. Elena Bennett. And I'm going to be talking about basically where we are growing food for our biggest cities and the type of ecological impacts that that's having. So I'm going to start off by talking about a much smaller city, which is Montreal in 1702. So it's that small black area in the bottom right-hand corner, and right now we know that as the Old Port. But it was originally settled because it was an Iroquois hunting ground and a trade outpost, and it had many rich natural resources. So naturally, that made it an ideal place to first settle. And if we zoom out a bit, we see these rectangular plots of land all along the water, which were called seigneuries, and they were used as farms. And 80% of the people lived in these rural areas at the time. So if we compare that to Montreal today, the red area shows that the urban area now encompasses basically the whole island, and the yellow and green areas show the kind of crop and forest and natural areas that feed the urban area's food and other essential services. So these natural areas can also be referred to as a hinterland or the less urban areas that surround cities but are still connected to them through social, economic, and physical processes. And when we consider the urban area together with this surrounding hinterland, this can be called a city region. So if you think of how big the city region is for Montreal right now, we can think of people going skiing in the Laurentians, so that would be nature tourism. We can think of food being grown in the eastern townships, which is then brought and consumed in the city, or even hydroelectric dams, which produce the electricity that's consumed in the city. And then if we expand this to a global perspective, we know that cities really occupy a very small portion of the land, less than 3%, but each of these cities is located in a place that's very, very rich in potential natural resources. So if we were to remove these city regions for all of the world's biggest cities, the planet would look something like this. And although there's still quite a bit of land left, if we look at what that land's composed of, it's mostly tundra, high-latitude forests, desert, and bare ground, and actually only 3% of it is used for cropping. So this kind of illustrates why we need to manage these city regions very carefully to produce food, but also while preserving the ecosystem functions within the region. So we can analyze these ecosystem functions in the region using what's called ecosystem services, which are the benefits that people obtain from ecosystems. And they can be categorized into three categories. So the provisioning services, which are the hard goods that people consume, like crops and water, and then there are regulating services, like carbon sequestration or water quality, and cultural services, which is everything from hunting to the spirituality that people get out of a sense of nature to recreating in a city park. So we know that 82% of the land surface has been altered by humans in some way, and this is especially true in city regions where everything is the way it is for a purpose, to produce goods that's then consumed by cities or by cities abroad. So a more, like, if we were to implement plans like urban agriculture and urban greening, while these serve noble purposes, we know that the demand for these ecosystem services will always be exceeded. Sorry, the demand will always be exceeded by the supply, which is what necessitates cities using hinterlands to produce these goods for them. And a more traditional take on urban ecology had ecologists looking at things like biodiversity in cities or water quality in streams. But this concept has kind of expanded to not only include the ecology going on in the cities, but the ecology going on of the city. So that's between the city and its surrounding rural areas, and between the city and other cities internationally. So for example, if we think about like demands for bananas in Montreal, we can't produce bananas ourselves. But through our demands, we've changed land use abroad, converted it to crops, and maybe altered hydro systems, biodiversity, and affected a whole slew of other ecosystem services. So there's some conceptualizations of what land use looks like surrounding a city, and this is the earliest one by von Thunen in 1826. And basically the people would live in a small urban core where there would be a market and people could trade goods and services. And then as you get further away from the core, real estate costs go down. So at the furthest reach of the city region, you'd have the most extensive practices, which are ranching and livestock. And then really close to the core, where real estate's more expensive, you'd have intensive practices like dairy farming and market gardening for vegetables. However, this model we know isn't true anymore, because since 1826, there have been some substantial changes in transportation technology. And this has enabled cities to trade with one another, and in some cases made it cheaper to import a good than to produce it themselves. So that has changed the way that they've used their land. And currently the theory on how the largest cities work is that they work as a mega region, which instead of having one urban core, they'll have many urban cores spread around the region that are connected over a shared knowledge, shared transportation networks, shared labor force, and often similar industries. And these modern cities are actually having more than 50% of their land use impacts internationally. So not in their own region, not in the next region over, but internationally. And it's not really clear how ecosystem services have been affected by this international land use change. So in my research, I try to answer the question, how does the supply of ecosystem services compare in urban regions around the world? And if you were to visualize the answer to that, well, we talked about Montreal earlier, so it might look something like this. And you would see staple crops grown all along the water of the St. Lawrence. You would see livestock grown a bit inland into the east. and you might see in nature recreation the Adirondack Mountains or Mont Tremblant National Park. And when you look at all these together, it gives a good idea of how we as consumers have shaped these regions and shaped the ecological functions of the regions. So in my study, I'm looking at, it's a global study, so I'm looking at over 700 cities, and all of them have populations greater than 500,000, and I'm mapping these ecosystem services around them in the 200 kilometers around them. And the services I'll be mapping and modeling are carbon sequestration and storage, livestock production, air quality, water availability and quality, recreation in nature, and staple crop production. And I don't really have the time to get into all the models that I've made, but they're mainly empirically based. So to look at some preliminary results, here's the staple crop production in city regions around the world. And we see that in southern Asia, there's much higher staple crop production. And this fits with kind of what we would expect because of their diet, because they export a lot of these staple crops abroad, and they're very high in calories. But what's interesting to think about is how the other ecosystems in their region have, what trade-offs have occurred with the other ecosystem services, because growing this many crops may come at the expense of one or more of them. So to look at that, we look at a bundle of ecosystem services. And so here's an example of what a bundle of services might look like in Western Europe. And this is kind of difficult to interpret, but basically each arm of this spider's web is a different ecosystem service. And as you get further away from the core, that means that there's more of that service occurring. And we see that some services tend to occur together, creating a synergy of services, and some services tend to occur when the other one is not there, creating a trade-off. So in this case, in Western Europe, they have very, very high livestock production. But if you look at their water quality, it's actually extremely low. And their amount of carbon storage has also suffered. So you can imagine how these different bundles of services might look for different regions around the world, and what type of factors might affect these bundles that we see. So why do we care about this, and what are the implications on food security? Well, through looking at these ecosystem service bundles, we can identify trade-offs that are occurring with food production and see how this changes over space. So for example, in my data, I've already seen that, like we just saw that in Western Europe, they were able to produce a lot of livestock, but their water quality suffered. Well, the same is not true for Australia, that actually produces more livestock, but their water quality was in a much better state. So looking at how these trade-offs can be managed differently across space. And then there's also this ethical dimension of knowing, as consumers, we often don't see the impacts of our decisions that we make, and really pinpointing how we're changing landscapes around us, but not only that, but how our consumption changes are affecting communities abroad, and maybe just bringing this to light, which is a very abstract concept. And lastly, I just wanted to say that in the environmental field, I think urban areas are just looked at as huge centers of demand for natural resources, and often that gives it a bad reputation of, or some kind of hotspot and something that's destroying nature. But to me, I see cities more as bright spots, because having these dense hubs of population means that there's also a huge potential for solutions. Like if we figure out ways to consume resources more efficiently or reduce waste, increase global equity, these will have instantaneous effects on billions of people. So, thank you.